just have a lot of curiosity at solving big problems. Now, about the topic of animal welfare, which I think all of your audience would be familiar with, I think we need a reboot on animal welfare. I think we need to start over as an industry.
Swine. It's time for a new era of communication in the swine industry, one that you can get the latest updates while commuting or driving to farms. Here, you will have the brightest minds of the global swine industry in your pocket. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adisseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. AB Vista, new nutritional perspectives and novel enzyme applications to drive pig production. DSM Firmenich, you can combat mycotoxins in your feed with Fumezyme from DSM Firmenich. Fumezyme is the only FDA-approved enzyme to degrade fumonisins. Eastman works with you to accelerate your nutritional program innovation. MetaFarms, transforming agricultural with data-driven solutions for pork producers.
Hello, and welcome to our Swine It podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Donovan, your host, and today I have with me as my guest, Dr. John McGlone. Dr. McGlone is a professor at Texas Tech University, where he has established the Laboratory of Animal Behavior, Physiology, and Welfare. Welcome to our show, Dr. McGlone. It's been a while since we visited. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to have this venue to be able to talk, which is really mostly what I'm going to do, as opposed to presenting data, which I'm not going to do.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes, this is a discussion, and this is an opportunity to really get to know you a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Dr. McGlone has been a guest on our show before, but just in case you haven't listened in or haven't met him before, he's a world-renowned expert in animal welfare. He's known for his practical research in the welfare of farming practices in several species. He's been a mentor for many, many graduate students and practitioners like myself in the field of animal welfare, and I'm so excited to have you. So, Dr. McGlone, you've had over 40 years of animal behavior and welfare experience, and so can you give us some highlights of your career just so that we can get to know you a little bit better and how you got where you are?
Yeah, it was a long path, convoluted up until the end. So, I did my undergraduate work at Washington State University, which at the time in the 70s had an extension swine veterinarian, had pig reproductive biologists, pig nutritionists. It had a whole bunch of people that got me really interested in pigs. And I worked as an undergraduate for three professors, one in nutrition, one in reproductive physiology, and one in stress and behavior and physiology. And so I continued in grad school in that area of behavior and physiology. And I got my PhD at University of Illinois in 1981, you don't need to calculate how long ago that was. Stan Curtis was my advisor. Some of the older members of your audience will remember Stan. He was a flamboyant, outgoing, larger-than-life figure that's no longer with us. But I spent 3 years at University of Wyoming after graduation as the extension, a three-way appointment, teaching research and extension. I was the extension swine specialist for Wyoming, which is kind of weird, especially at the time. Then I got the job at Texas Tech University because they had a research farm, and I was mostly interested in research, and they didn't have anything to do. It was like an open farm. It was 120 sows. I could do whatever I wanted with them. So that's really why I went there, to be able to do the kinds of research that I was interested in. And so that was in 1984. So we're going on 40 years with Texas Tech. I really only had two jobs in my life, which is not common, I think, among most people. So my PhD work involved pheromones and pigs. And that was completely, nobody knew anything about it at that point. You know, it was just some, I thought, here's an area that nobody knows anything about, therefore there's a lot of opportunity. So I dug in. But then there was no funding for pheromone research at all when I graduated, but there was a lot of funding became available for animal welfare. And so I've done a lot of work in sow housing and castration and tail docking and blah, blah. Each aspect of pork production, transportation, I've published a fair bit. I just have a lot of curiosity at solving big problems. Now, about the topic of animal welfare, which I think all of your audience would be familiar with, I think we need a reboot on animal welfare. I think we need to start over as an industry. And I'll tell you why I think that. In 1980, when I was a grad student, Stan took me to the, then was NPPC headquarters in Des Moines. And we were called there. He was called there. He brought me along because he liked me to drive, you know. And at that time, 1980, the Humane Society of the United States, who's not a big player in animal welfare today, the farm animal, they're a player, not a big player. They had sent a postcard to all the producers, and the postcard had a picture of a breakfast plate with bacon and eggs only, and it said, "The Breakfast of Cruelty." Now, you remember the Wheaties boxes that had the Breakfast of Champion? It looked like a Wheaties box, the postcard, with Breakfast of Cruelty with bacon and eggs, and they were critical of gestation crates and sows and cages for chickens that are laying eggs. And so they said, what should we do about this? And I don't know if I said or Stan probably said, we have to study it. Look, we need to know, are they suffering? Are they not? Are there better ways to do things? We just need to incorporate this into our research portfolio. And the response to the industry in 1980 was, nah, this is not going to go anywhere. These people are idiots. They don't know what they're talking about. They've never been on a farm. It's not going to be a problem in the future. So no, we're not going to. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to fund one project next year on animal welfare. I forget what it was about. And they dabbled in a little bit, and then later they began doing research in it. Now, what was obvious in 1980, the main animal welfare problems on the farm are not sow housing. Sow housing, and I've written about this, sow housing, if you, as a professional of any ilk in the pig industry, walk through a pig farm that has crates, gestation crates, that is not the biggest problem on that farm, by far. It's a much bigger problem that 10% of the finishing pigs are dying, or 15% of the sows are dying, or the diseases that are running rampant through the facility. These are huge animal welfare problems. Whether she's in a crate or not, it is a relatively minor welfare problem. Yet to the public, it looks ugly, right? The crate. I mean, it doesn't look good. So the industry had a choice in the 80s. And one of the things some of us argued for was we need to find alternatives to the crate. Something that works as well as the crate, is as economical as a crate, doesn't have any reproductive problem. Well, the industry said, we're not interested in that. Now, they did start funding it in the late 90s. In the 90s, they came, 10 years later, they said, okay, maybe we need to find an alternative to crate. They fund a project here, a project there. Now, let me contrast that with pseudorabies, how the industry handled it. The industry decided pseudorabies was a problem. They got with the USDA, they got funding. At the time, Upjohn had a gene-edited vaccine. And in I don't know how many years, you might know, because it's really your field, but in, I don't know, 10 years, 20 years, they eradicated pseudorabies from the United States. It was a global, not global, a national effort that was successful. When I was a student, the biggest diseases we were dealing with on farms was atrophic rhinitis, respiratory disease, and every once in a while, a little bit of salmonella and rotavirus, and then every once in a while, we get TGE. That was in the 70s. And hog cholera. We got rid of hog cholera. That was a concerted, directed effort by veterinarians and the government and the producers to actually do something. Both of those programs were successful. Why haven't we done that with PRRS or PED? I don't know.
We have a time and labor-saving product for you.
AgriSlats by Healthy Farms is your solution. No more lugging jugs around the barn every month. With AgriSlats, you simply drop the slat through the floor twice a year, and it works to break down solids, reduces crusting and forming. To learn more, visit myhealthyfarms.com.
I agree with you, and you're exactly right.
It's actually not that expensive to do that. I mean, we know we can look up in the history how much it costs to make those special vaccines. And
yeah, one of the challenges I know is you know, you've just got to have, it's the concerted effort, right? And just the regulatory programs. Those were regulatory. The USDA was on board, and so then it was reportable, testable, you know, accountable. And so we just haven't had that opportunity yet. And
why not? We got another billions of dollars from the government for other purposes, but apparently yeah. That's not important enough to warrant funding, right? So, okay, I'm just taking the big picture now, right?
Absolutely.
We know we're able to do it. We know we're able to get the industry and the government together towards a common problem and solve it. We know we can do that, but we're not doing it. So now, on animal welfare, kind of a problem for the industry right now. And the first problem with animal welfare is that nobody can define animal welfare. In 1990, there was a meeting in Maryland. They invited 100 people only, activists, politicians, scientists, a few veterinarians. And they said, we need to define animal welfare. There was a 3-day meeting at a resort in the middle of nowhere you couldn't leave. And we had lectures and arguments and roundtables. And at the end of it, we couldn't define animal welfare. So why can't we define animal welfare? Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that it means different things to different people. So in laboratory animals, which I've done a lot of work with laboratory animals too. In the laboratory animal world, where ALAC is the accreditation body and USDA oversees laboratory animals, the Animal Welfare Act is a minimum standard for animals that are used in research and a few other purposes. Minimum standards. So when I was one of the editors of the Ag Guide, and I gave a talk in Europe, and I was bragging about the Ag Guide and how great it is, and this woman stands up from the EU and she says, This is horrible what you're doing. Why would you even call that animal welfare? I said, well, we need to meet the needs of the animals, and we want it to be based on science, and this is what the science says they need. She said, no. You think they need a minimum, whatever that minimum said. We think they need the maximum welfare, not the least amount of welfare that they don't die, but the most amount of welfare so they have a happy, enjoyable life. So at the time, we were discussing environmental enrichment, and you know, it's found in laboratory animals. Every laboratory animal facility in the modern world uses environmental enrichment, or else the regulators get upset. So that's an example of something that they think provides the animal more enrichment, even though they don't know how to provide environmental enrichment to the animals. Okay, but it needs to be provided. So there's all kinds of different things, from Coke cans to tufts of wool to whatever, in lab animal facilities that animals can play with. And and the EU, it's a law that they have to provide environmental enrichment. In Brazil, it's a law now that they have to provide environmental enrichment. Smithfield has said they're going to provide environmental enrichment by 2035, and the rest of the industry isn't even talking about it, even though it's like a demand. So we can't define what level of welfare. If we could define the word, it might be okay. We could figure out levels, but you can't get agreement on what it means. You take the sows out of the gestation crate, put them in a group pen, show that to the activists. They are not going to be happy with that. That's not good enough for them. You can't define it, and it means different things to different people. So we shouldn't even be talking about animal welfare, in my view. We should change the conversation. and we should change it to behavioral management. Pork producers should be able to stand up and say, we provide behavioral management for our pigs, and we meet all of their needs 100% of the time. We also meet a portion of their wants. They might want to go out and root in the dirt, but we can't let them do that. So we provide them another alternative to meet that behavioral want. And if you want to provide for behavioral wants, which doesn't provide economic value, you need to pay for that product, right? More. And you can pay for it more now, or you can pay for it more later after everybody goes out of business with the old system, and you're only left with that with a chronically elevated price. At the same time, the U.S. Congress has two bills in front of it, the Senate, and it shows the division or divisiveness in the U.S., and it relates to animal welfare. So Cory Booker has a bill that wants to outlaw confined animal feeding operations. Okay, so he's got 100 sponsors on it, 100 congressmen and senators agree with him. Grassley from Iowa has a bill called the EATS bill that says one state cannot regulate the animal welfare in another state. He doesn't have quite as many co-sponsors yet, but both bills are the opposite, right? They're the opposite of each other. And they can't both be right, but they can both be wrong, which is what the situation is, I think. So Booker's bill is completely unrealistic, and so is Grassley's, in my view. Now, if you look at consumers, you find a range of consumers. And I would agree with people that have said, I'm not the first person to say this, that if you force people to use a higher cost of production method, then you're going to force everybody to pay more for their meat. That means the poor people in San Francisco are maybe not going to have as good a diet, or they're going to spend more money on meat because of a law that they passed in the state of California that hurts poor people in California. And that's not right either. Right? So the solution, now I want to go back in time a little bit to the chicken business, specifically the egg-laying business. And I was a small part of some of those conversations. I don't know as much about that, of course. The chicken people got together, I don't know how many years ago, X years ago, and said, let's quit fighting these people. Let's quit fighting them. Let's find out what they want, make them pay for it, and give it to them. So everybody gets what they want. So when you go to Walmart, of all places, wasn't the case when Walmart first was out, but today you go to Walmart and you look at the egg counter. There's white eggs, usually in my store, they're on the bottom, and they're $1.80 a dozen or whatever, and they get more expensive as they go up. And then you have cage-free, they're a little more expensive, and then you have antibiotic cage-free, and they're a little more, and you have free range and a little more, and organic or a little more. They have this range of products. Then take a few steps over to the side of the pork case. There's one kind of pork there. You want a pork chop as opposed to an egg? Pork chop to go with your egg. That's kind of a good meal. Pork chop to go with your egg? There's only one kind of pork chop there. The way it doesn't say whether the sow was in a crate, it does. Yeah, if you go to Whole Foods, it's different. But if for the regular grocery store or Walmart, we're talking about, there's one kind of pork. We're not giving the consumer what they want. Now, maybe they only want 2% Prop 12 and 8% halfway there, and the rest of them don't care, whatever the percentages are. We need to know what our consumer wants and give it to them.
I have a quick question about that for you. So don't you think that if you provide all these different types of housing or, you know, modifications or, you know, et cetera, farming modifications, that it looks like the white egg at the bottom of the counter that, you know, doesn't say cage-free and doesn't say organic is worse, right? Those, you know, those hens are treated poorly. Is that the perception though, when you give all these levels, or at least that's an argument that I've heard, right? That all of our pork should be, all of our pork should be raised in a manner where the animals are.
Remember that people have different definitions of welfare. So the mother that comes in says, if she knew, which she doesn't, but if she did, she would say, oh, the white egg has a chicken in a cage, but it's half the price of the chicken that's not in a cage. But I've only got X dollars to feed my family. I don't care that much about animal welfare, so I'm going to buy the white eggs. Now, later, when she becomes rich, maybe she'll buy the other egg, but I doubt it. That's what she'll buy. And then somebody says, well, I care about, I don't want them in cages, but I don't care about this other organic crap. And so you get the middle egg. They have choices. With pork, there should be the same range of product. Now, if Grassley and Booker were to get together and to say, what will solve both of our problems if we just put a QR code on every piece of meat, and you can pop up exactly how that animal was raised, whether it was in a building or on the pasture or antibiotics or no or whatever, then that solves the problem. And one's cheaper than the other. Why is it cheaper? Click on the QR code. And because you can't have a whole long explanation on a label, right?
Well, you know, it makes me think about that very first conversation earlier today that we had. And you said that there was a person in your animal welfare group that said, why aren't we providing, you know, the maximum amount of comfort or welfare, right, instead of the minimum amount? And right. So, you know, I guess, aren't we striving to have some, I guess what I see is there's minimum standards, right, that we should have for swine and for housing, et cetera. And that's the approach that our industry has taken. Right. Here's the minimum. Right. And maybe that right or wrong.
We're not totally truthful about them. I mean, they're close. Yeah. Okay. So the Swine Care Handbook, which we say we adhere to, has space requirement for pigs up to, I forget what it is, 260 pounds of 8 square feet and 9 square feet above that. And how many farms comply with that?
None
that are going to make money, none that are going to be profitable. So how can you take profitability out of the animal welfare equation? You can't do that. But you also can't hide the thing. You can't hide the truth either. You can't, because eventually you'll be found out, right? So
sure. And the discussion around that is, you know, you've taken your first markets out, right? Then your square footage is different, right? That's the discussion that always occurs in that auditing process.
It's only a problem for about a month. Anyway, so if we stop talking about animal welfare and start talking about behavioral needs and wants, we can make progress because we can objectively measure behavior. The second thing is, the pigs on farms in the world are bored. And boredom leads to behavior problems. And so that was the reason that people wanted environmental enrichment. When we started on the environmental enrichment road, which partway through the evolution of my thinking on environmental enrichment, is why are people not doing that? Why are they not providing enrichment? Well, because they have to pay something to put a toy in there and there's no return. So nobody wants to do that. And you do it when you're forced to do it, but you don't do it out of wanting to hurt your pocketbook. You do it because it's required. So if environmental enrichment paid for itself, people would use it. Don't you think? I mean, if you had to pay a dollar for environmental enrichment and it returned you $1.50, you might actually be willing to do it.
Yeah, I think that's anything, right? Yeah. If you can show a profit, right? Then it's a return.
So I set out to engage the pigs more in their daily life. And so I developed this sprayer that we're going to talk a little more about later, but the sprayer where the pig could, I set design criteria for environmental enrichment. It had to be sanitizable, had to be up off the floor. It had to provide this rooting, digging motion, and it had to give some kind of reward to the pig. Those were the criteria. And I came up with the sprayer where it has a front plate on it, and the pig pushes on it and it squirts him in the face with the liquid. And if you put that in a pen with the pig, they'll use it once or twice a day, every day, although some pigs use it a lot. They like it. They like to be sprayed in the face. And so I thought, well, okay, we can use this to deliver pheromone. So instead of, for gilt development, for example, instead of having somebody going around spraying each gilt with pheromone, which is just as bad as running a boar through the pen, you put the sprayer out there, let them give it to themselves. Let them give the pheromone to themselves. And if they give it to themselves, guess how many doses of pheromone they give themselves a day when they're in heat? More than 20. We're not giving them enough boar exposure as it is. Once a day is not enough. And that's if you're doing a good job, you might get by. So we've done some studies with the sprayer where the gilts self-apply the pheromone, which provides enrichment, but also the pheromone. And we got one study in Missouri, we got 93% of the gilts cycling with an H&S before they were bred. 93% of them, no boars, just the pheromone. Now, when we spray them once a day, we're not quite as good as the boar, but that made me conclude that once a day is not enough to get full estrus detection at a reasonable time after pubertal development. So when you start managing the behavior of the pig, let it give itself what it needs and what it wants. It'll give itself what it wants. It's totally up to the pig. And so then you probably know Rebecca Robbins, who's a vet. And
I do, yeah.
Works at PIC now. So she's close. So I needed a local pig vet. The Texas Tech vets are not pig vets. So I need to have a close by. I have Scanlon Daniels, who I'm sure you know, and Rebecca Robbins, my go-to people locally, right? So I call Rebecca and I say, listen, Rebecca, I got this sprayer, it delivers pheromone. What do you think about vaccinating pigs with it? Letting them vaccinate themselves? And she said, that sounds crazy. Nobody's going to believe that. Then I talked to a funding agency. I said, you know, I think we can get the pigs to vaccinate themselves and save labor, a lot of labor, and maybe get good efficacy on vaccine uptake. And they said, okay, we know you're crazy. Just come back. Go away. No, they weren't interested in funding it. Then we published the paper where we put salmonella vaccine in that sprayer that I sent you a copy of. You can find it. It's 2023 paper. And the pigs vaccinated the heck out of themselves. And all the pigs were vaccinated within 80 minutes of putting the sprayer in the pen. And the titers we got from the pigs, finishing pigs, were higher from the self-vaccination than they were from the control that we hand-vaccinated. The titers were better, were higher. We didn't do a disease challenge study, of course. And because they get it all over their face. It's on their eyes, in their mouth, it's in their nose, they breathe it in. We literally have seen sow, and they don't all do this, or finishing pig, go up to that sprayer and keep pushing on it with their mouth on the hole to drink it. Because it's fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
See, when you make the environment fun for the pig will work for you. He'll be one of your employees. It'd take one person a short period of time to vaccinate 10,000 pigs by just putting the bottle in the thing. So then I went back to the, you know, I started talking about the work we finished, and Schick said, you know, maybe it's not such a crazy idea after all. So we have studies ongoing where we're looking at Lawsonia vaccine delivered this way, influenza, erysipelas, and one more. Micro. So we're doing four studies to see, because, you know, different antigens deliver different ways, lead to different titers, and we don't know if the ones you give IM are going to work.
Right. So you're working on an IM, a traditional IM product, but going orally with it.
Yeah. And I think we know enough about the behavior of the pigs. If it doesn't work because it has to go IM, we could make the pigs inject themselves.
Now that would be great. Every contract grower out there would be interested in that, right?
Well, they can currently do it with these, but I think that we could, we could do that. Because the technology is out there, it's just a matter of syncing up the behavior of the pig with the device so that they use it properly.
Well, if you think about the oral fluid testing, right, that we use now widely, I mean, every swine veterinarian is so thankful to Dr. Zimmerman and his research team because, you know, we bled pigs and that's not an easy task. The pigs don't like it and the people don't like it. And that has just been so amazing in testing. And it's also a beef behavior modification, right? I mean, it's a if you put a rope in a group of finisher pigs, there's not one finisher pig after a period of time, if you leave it there long enough and can get rope to stay on the pen, they will all go there. They all they're curious.
And let me give you one other tidbit. So I modified the sprayer, the last manufacturing, to make it a dip in the bottom so that you can go, because they're slobbering all over that.
Oh, sure.
And so now you can go to any pen anytime and collect oral fluids from that pen without having to hang a rope or just go over and suck it out through the syringe.
Interesting.
So you don't need ropes. You don't need anything except the sprayer. You need the sprayer. So, but getting the pig to help you by vaccinating themselves, in the case of pheromones, give them a more appropriate dose. In the case of environmental enrichment, we can also change how much they use the sprayer. So one of the pheromones that I've developed is called a maternal pheromone. And it's a sow piglet pheromone. And it's very attractive to pigs of all ages. So in these studies, we put the sprayer out in the pen. The pigs are used to it, so they only go once or twice a day. We put the vaccine in there and squirt, literally a squirt bottle of maternal pheromone on the front of that sprayer, and they all come over and get vaccinated.
Interesting.
Yeah, within 80 minutes, they're all vaccinated. But there was one pen, they vaccinated themselves within 5 minutes. It's variation among pens, you know. They just swarmed it, and they were just covered in the blue. We put reload in it that's a dark blue, and you can see it on their faces. So managing the behavior of the pig to deliver animal health problems is a lot better than hiring people to do it. First of all, the people are inefficient. They miss a few animals. They break needles. They get injured. It's hard work. Terrible in the summer when it's really hot. I mean, you know, pigs are there anyway. They're not doing anything. You might as well do that, right? So going back to animal welfare, when we start managing the behavior of the animals, now all of a sudden people, anybody in the general public, would think this is positive. You're giving the pig something to do. It's entertained. You can increase or decrease the use of the sprayer with the pheromone. You can, if you have a behavioral problem, you can make them use it more. If you don't have a behavioral problem, they can use it less. It's an environmental enrichment device that more than pays for itself. Now, it's being developed, okay? It's not, don't ask me the number and where to order one, because we're still working on it. But let's go back to behavior instead of welfare, okay? if you were looking at a sow and you said, like, let's say the bunch of sows were weaned in Prop 12 farm and there's a bunch of scratches on them and fighting and all that, and you stand there with somebody from outside that's not in the pig industry, you say, what do you think about the welfare of these animals? We'll say, well, they have scratches. Yeah, they have scratches, but that's normal. They're establishing the dominance. You understand? It's consistent with the behavioral biology of the pig that they fight. Not that much, but a little bit, at least a little bit. They have to fight to establish dominance. We manage this behavior. We do everything we can to reduce the aggression, and we let them socially interact, and we provide for their behavioral wants to socially interact. We also provide some feeding stalls over here in case a sow wants to be isolated because she's not a dominant sow. So, you can make the whole story about how you provide for the welfare of the individual animal in a group without ever saying anything about welfare. We meet their behavioral needs and we meet their behavioral wants. And we do it in this way by doing all of these things. So the reboot that I'm talking about is that I think we should stop thinking when we say we provide for the welfare of the animals and the activist says they do not provide for the welfare of the animals, the two definitions are not the same. So why keep using a word you can't define? Let's tell them what we can define and let's use it. Now, you think, okay, now behavior might not cover everything. Oh, yes, it does. It covers everything. So let's say you're interested in feed intake. Well, feeding behavior is a behavior. You're managing feeding behavior. You're managing feeding behavior by having the feeder designed a certain way where they can get access to it, where they don't waste feed, but they heat feed. We're managing their behavior by managing the equipment. What about animal health? Rebecca Robbins loves this one. 100% of infectious disease problems are behavior problems. 100%. Every time a pig gets infected with a pathogen, it requires it to behave. It's got to either breathe or lick or touch or whatever, get in contact with the pathogen. So it gets exposed to the pathogen through its behavior. If we could stop pigs from doing certain behaviors, we would stop infectious disease. Now, we don't want to stop them from grooming each other and eating feces and stuff like that. We don't really want to stop them from doing that, but that's how they get it. They get it through their behavior. Secondly, after they're infected and they get sick, how do we know they're sick? The first way we know they're sick, by their behavior. There's a whole field in biomedical science and a tiny field in agricultural science called sickness behavior, where people study sickness behavior. And so people are working on smart barn technology where they're looking at the behavior of pigs that have certain diseases and seeing if they can develop an algorithm to say when they behave this way, that means they have this disease or that they're sick. So it's about behavior. And people that are good husbandry people, what are they really good at? They're good at understanding pig behavior.
Yeah, picking out a pig that's sick or not, you know, that's thin or hanging out in the corner or not getting up when everybody else gets up. Exactly, it's observation. Yeah, it is behavior.
So on the reboot that I'm talking about, the reboot of the industry, we need to get different people together and say, what is the kind of facility that meets the behavioral needs and maybe wants of pigs? Is it concrete slats? No. Is it 15 parts per million ammonia in the building? No. Is it crowding? No. I mean, what is it? What is it that we want? We want their feet and legs to be healthy. We want their lungs to be healthy. We want their body to be healthy when they go to slaughter, obviously. So what do we need to do that? What are the criteria? The barn that we have today, if you were to build a new farm today, it doesn't look that different than a farm 40 years ago that was built. Really, we've made no progress on any kind of innovation. Now, the smart barn technology is moving that way, okay? We have to give them credit for it. But there's a bunch of engineers. They don't know about the behavior of the pig. They're learning. But you know, they need to incorporate the behavior into their models. And we need to incorporate behavioral training into swine veterinarians so that they can understand the behavior of the pig. You walk in the barn and almost immediately know what's wrong based on the behavior of the pig. And you're doing this already, you and your colleagues. I know you are because I've seen it. You know, when you walk in a barn and say, look, the pigs are huddling, it's too cold. You didn't say that because you felt chilly. You said that because you watched the pig behavior. So also back in the 90s, this idea, I didn't come up with this idea. This was an idea from the 90s. USDA contacted me. They said, listen, we have this problem that I just described. So we're going to build a big pig farm and we can build a better pig farm. They were going to build 2 600 sow farms in Iowa that could be modified and we can look at new penning configurations and designs and all kinds of things like that. Because there's no innovation coming from the universities on this topic, except very incremental, slow progress, right? The real innovation is coming from the industry. I mean, the Gestahl and the NEDAP systems were not really developed at a university by scientists working out, developed by engineers that know about pigs, right? Innovation is coming from the industry today. When I was a student, innovation was coming from the universities because now the funding model has changed and there's no money for innovation. If you want to get a federal grant under the title of innovation, you still have to have preliminary data and show that you can do it before you get the money to do it. So there's no emphasis on innovation or starting over or trying things that might fail, which is part of the whole process, right? You try this, it might fail. I did a lot of work with outdoor pigs. I don't know if you knew that, but probably published more paper on outdoor pigs than anybody. But it didn't work. It failed. And I spent, I don't know, 15 years to come to that conclusion. It just is not going to work for the majority of people. And the main reason that it won't work, can you guess? A wise one?
My guess is because our environmental temperature is so variable at different states across the U.S. No.
You got to look at those snow igloos in Canada where the feral pigs are building igloos living in the tundra. No, it's not temperature. No, it's the biggest reason it failed is food safety. We couldn't keep salmonella and influenza out of the herd. We couldn't do it. We tried, couldn't do it. The birds are continually infecting those fields. You can't stop them in a humane way. And, you know, obviously influenza and COVID now, people are a little more afraid of those kind of things. So I think it's not because of environmental reasons. It's not because of economics either. It's not because it takes more room because it really doesn't. It's really about food safety. You can't produce safe food outdoors 100% of the time. Okay, so USDA tried to do that, and they asked Congress for money, and it didn't get funded. So nobody has ever said let's get 5,000 sow farms and look at different variations on things, and let's take one farm that's completely got nothing and start over, and see what that farm would look like. Nobody's doing that.
Yeah, there's little, you know, like you mentioned, incremental, either industry and academia working on, you know, a design of a pen or the design of a, you know, different maybe type of flooring or water mechanism, right? But yeah, not a concerted industry effort.
There's a little bit of that in Europe, but it's, I would call it goofy, not something that's going to be adopted very easily. But people in Europe are trying a little bit, but as I say, the smart barn technology is going in the right direction. We like design criteria for a new farm. We need to run a modern farm with 90% fewer people. That's a goal, and maybe more than 90% fewer.
I think your mention of, you know, a device that administers or the pigs administer a vaccine themselves is 100%. The way, you know, the way of the future, robotics and, you know, mechanized loading chutes and gates and, you know, this, some kind of a, you know, perhaps collar that, you know, moves the gate system to load the trucks themselves, right, because the labor is, we're not going to have it.
And really what we want to do for our animal science graduates, I can put a plug in for them. We would like them to have a job that involves some technology. We don't want our graduates pressure washing barns all day, right? Now they need to know how to do that, but that needs to not be their day. They need to be able to be a little more scientific and creative in their job. And they could do that if you were managing a smart farm as opposed to working at the smart farm. If you're managing it with computers and checking on them occasionally, it would be much better for everybody, I think, for the pigs and the people. But to really be able to do that, you got to understand the pig behavior, and you got to make the environment accommodate the behavior of the pig. So giving themselves pheromones, giving themselves antibiotics, giving themselves vaccines. And then we have our old friends, the feral pigs. Feral pigs are a concern, of course, because of African swine fever. But they're a concern even before that. And Texas has been famous for spending a lot of money on traps and bullets. And while they've done that, they've spent millions of dollars on that. The pig population has gone up. It's not working. Now, how long do you do something that's not working before you change your approach? How long does the industry go? Now, 40 years with saying, it'll go away, or we'll make some little changes and then they'll shut up. No, they'll never shut up. You got to engage it and give them what they want. Find out what the consumers want, first of all, and then give them what they want. And then adjust the industry accordingly. Some people can have sows in crates. Some people can have them at Prop 12 farms. Some can have whatever. I mean, we can produce pigs any number of ways. We know how to produce pigs. We can do it if we know what the market wants and match the market with the production. That's what the poultry industry has done with eggs. And we haven't done that. And I wouldn't say there's been a lot of innovation in the move from cages to housing of hens either. Not a lot of it. There's some, but a little bit. Because the question is then, when you don't have them in a cage, how do you manage their behavior so they don't kill each other and so they keep producing hens?
Right. Right.
So, anyway, I think the whole system is suffering, and the young people today don't see it. Because when Stan Curtis was my advisor in the late 70s and early 80s, he was given money by the university, called Hatch Fund, to do whatever he wanted with it. It was like $20,000 in 1977. It's probably like $100,000 today. He could do whatever he wanted with that. And he was innovative. He had a study where you probably don't know this, he had a study where he put the thermostat in a pen of pigs and let them turn it on whenever they wanted heat. And there was one pen had the thermostat with a paddle. Every time they hit it, the heater would come on for 5 minutes. And if they kept hitting it, and in the middle of the night, there'd be a pile of pigs that are a little bit chilly. One pig would go over and hit it and go back and lay down. And so what happened with those barns is they actually saved energy because they gave themselves a diurnal cycle in temperature, not 90 degrees all day, wean pigs. It wasn't 90 degrees all 24 hours. It was 90 degrees for about 6 hours. Then it was 80, 85, and then back up to 90, and then later lower. It kept getting lower and lower. And so, and then that work just went away because we didn't let the pigs manage their own environment.
Right, right. We manage it for them. Well, that's really interesting in terms of, you've made me think a lot about what we don't use in terms of pig behaviors and what we could do, and kind of an exciting future for what pig farming might look in the next 50 years.
Oh, I really think it's going to look very different. I do. I think it will, but I don't know how it's going to happen because not enough people are working on it. But I think the innovation will come from the producers because.
Yeah, it always does. It always does.
It almost always does. Yeah. Occasionally, I like to go on a farm and see something that I've worked on, you know, that they're doing. I would say the big innovation comes from the industry. The incremental innovation comes from the university.
I agree. And bringing it to the technical expertise of understanding, you know, all the pieces comes from the expertise of academia for sure.
So how crazy is it that pigs would vaccinate themselves? Does that seem like?
I mean, I think in terms of oral vaccinations, I'm not going to be a pessimist, but I think there's some diseases that, you know, are going to require some IM or some other, you know, maybe it's a dermal vaccination process and doesn't have to go IM, right? That's a way that you can get a respiratory pathogen. But in terms of the already oral vaccines that we have that we know work through a water medicator, I don't think it's crazy. I mean, spending a lot of time in a pig barn and watching pigs go after a rope or anything you put in the pen, whether it's another pig or, you know, an enrichment tool or you get in the pen with the pigs after a period of time, you know, they're curious about you. So it makes sense to me on a behavior standpoint. And I think that's really, you know, a unique thought process of let's change the discussion to looking at the pig and understanding the behavior and using that to assess whether they're comfortable or not. So I like that thought process because welfare is this, sometimes can be a word that, you know, feels like, I don't know what that is, right? I don't know what that is for each pig or each stage of pig. So no, very, very good conversation.
Want to improve feed biosecurity? VVC Premix from DSM Firmenich can reduce pathogen concentration of feed with proven results against ASF, PED, PRRS, and SVA. VVC Premix can also help improve gut functionality, weight gain, and feed efficiency. Learn more at dsm.com/VVC-Premix. It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Sunai, we provide value-added biotech solutions. Healthy Farms by Bioverse, your manure management experts. FeedFlow, feed is too expensive to ignore. Take control with FeedFlow. AccuFast, the best way to predict the future is to create it. Start creating your future today at AccuFastSwine.com. An animal nutrition technology company offering innovative products and new applications for the swine industry. The combination of AB Vista enzymes, technical services, and nutrition expertise provides the industry with new opportunities to further improve production efficiencies. Fiber is receiving renewed interest due to its influence on the microbiome, and AB Vista has brought together research experts to discuss the industry's knowledge of fiber functionality and to introduce a stimbiotic, targeted to improve fiber digestion. To request access, contact nam@abvista.com. That's nam@abvista.com.
I appreciate your time today. We're going to round out our session with the three questions that we ask all of our folks. So,
well, at least I remember what those were.
Well, I'll help you with those. So the first one, and these are easy. This is just for us to get to know you a little bit better. And so what's your favorite book or resource that you use in your area of expertise? So and it can be a website. It can be a book that you use that, you know, was your first behavior textbook. What's your go-to for your area?
I should say the book I wrote on pig production that's out of print now. That would be the go-to book. No, I think that from a general point of view, I think there's a book called, there's more than one book. Can I use more than one?
Sure.
It has to be one. There's a book called Sapien that tracks the history of humans. And I found it fascinating and how we got to where we're going and how things have changed and so on. Yeah, that would be great reading or listening if you're driving. Sapien is a good book. There's also a good book I read during the pandemic called The Great Influenza. Have you read that one?
I have.
And what was most fascinating about that is all the mistakes they made and how we made them again during COVID.
It repeats itself, right? That's what they say.
We're not learning. Why can't we learn? I don't understand why we can't learn. The website I use the most is Google Scholar. So when I was working with the maternal pheromone, you know, there's so many swine nutritionists in the world doing so many experiments down to the minutia of nutrition, which is very important, of course. I'm not saying it's not important. And so when I discovered the maternal pheromone, one of the ingredients in the maternal pheromone is skatol. And I said, so then I started studying the biochemistry of skatol. And I said, these nutritionists must, if you feed high levels of tryptophan to sows, the skatol levels go up.
Okay.
And Iowa State did a study with our maternal pheromone and sprayed it in the, where the heat lamp is, and they improved pre-weaning survival by 5%. So I thought, well, if we could feed tryptophan to sows at high levels, we could, they'd have more pheromone. And I thought, well, I don't have to do that study. And sure enough, there were two papers published, high levels of tryptophan improved baby pig survival.
Interesting.
Now it happens, tryptophan is very expensive to feed at those levels, and the skatol is very cheap. But so I think that Google Scholar is my favorite website.
Okay. So what about a favorite book or resource outside of agriculture or welfare or your area of expertise?
Well, there's too many ors there. There's a great book that I think should be required reading. It is for my students, for my graduate students. It was written in the 1800s. It's called Harris on the Pig. It was written by a guy named Harris, who at the time was a pig professional, 1889, something like that. And it's such a popular book, it's been reprinted. And it's got really useful information. The man that doesn't own the pigs is less likely to be nice to the pigs. Things like that, he says.
Okay. Interesting. I haven't heard of that.
Feeder designs and there's also a great book in the field. Seton Baxter wrote a book called Space and Place. Well, actually, a chapter is called Space and Place, but it's about pig farms and how to design them and how, based on the biology of the pig from years ago. Sapien is in the non-pig world, so we can count that one for that.
All right. Sounds good. Those are really interesting. I'll have to check some of those out. Probably written by true animal, behaviorist animal scientists or people who understand the behavior of the pig, right? Which before we had some of the science that we maybe hasn't helped us. So one last question is, share with us an attribute or characteristic that you feel sets successful professionals apart from others.
One is to be engaged in your topic, to have a plan for what you're doing now and a long-term plan. So in terms of research, my closest colleagues are researchers, right? You have a plan for what you're doing today. You're chasing this grant that's here, but you have to think about 10 years from now and 20 years from now and not just think about right now. I think that's what we're so bogged down in the immediate, you know. I get this grant, I immediately have to start writing another one because this one's going to run out. And you're just constantly in this treadmill of grants and publications and so on. I like the publications, I hate the grants, right? I mean, I've written a lot of grants in my day, but publications are much, if you had more time to write more papers, I'm about 20 papers behind, by the way. So. Yeah. And I really don't think, I think the young people today, we have to find a way to allow them to be innovative. And we're not doing that. Like for the young, this is what I meant. I tell young faculty, you have to spend some time alone every week. Set aside some time. You need to spend time alone writing. You need to spend some time alone thinking. Two different things. And all you're going to think about is, okay, what comes after this? What comes after that? And what is stopping us from getting from here to there? What was stopping us in years ago was we didn't have sophisticated enough chemistry to detect these pheromones. But today we do, and it's like a gold mine of stuff. I wish I had this in 1980. It would have been a whole different career. But we have it now, and so we can use it. And not only are there pheromones related to reproduction and maternal-natal interactions and aggressive behavior and submissive behavior, there are what we might call pheromones associated with disease. And so when animals are sick, again, you're too young to know this probably. Did you work with any barns that had TGE in your...
Oh, I did. Barns? I did.
You did. Okay. Well, you must have caught the last end of it. It's pretty rare now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was early. It was early, but yes.
Yep. You might have had this experience. The second time you went in a TGE barn, you open the door to the sow barn and you take one step in and you go, dang, he's got TGE. And you go look for the sows vomiting and you're shaking your head down the aisle and you're saying, well, sorry, producer, but this is a bad thing that's happening. Well, if you can smell it, the GC mass spec can smell it, or a dog can smell it, and we should be able to have those sensors in the barn all the time to be able to say, okay, hers is starting in barn 6 at this finishing site. And we will get there. We will get there because it's, I can see the data is already out there. The beginning of the data is already there. So, there's a lot of exciting things that happen.
There is. That's fascinating.
Okay. Well, we can talk more about that in another.
We can. Week. Yeah. That's our. We have a couple venues now that we can go from a take on some of our discussion points. So, thank you so much for your time. Again, this is Dr. John McGlone with Texas Tech, and thank you for being our guest on SwineNet Podcast.
Thanks for having me and for being a nice host. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Looking to elevate your brand and captivate audiences through the power of podcasting? Look no further. Introducing the custom podcast brought to you by Wisemetics, where we take care of the behind the scenes so that you can focus on what truly matters. Podcasting has become an invaluable tool for brand awareness, but let's face it, putting it into practice can be a daunting task. It's incredibly time consuming and requires technical know-how. But don't worry, we've got you covered. With our experienced team at the helm, we'll handle the operational aspects so you can channel your energy into what your company does best. Are you ready to unleash the podcasting potential of your company? Schedule a call with one of our specialists today at the link in the bottom of this episode. You'll also receive a free podcast strategy consult tailored to the unique needs and goals of your business.